Now we're studying Shemos, chapter 4, starting with verse 18, the strange event that's recorded when Moshe, finally he's had to accept the leadership position, and he takes his leave of Yisro and he returns to Egypt. So something very unexpected occurs on the way back. Well, let's go through the psukim. It says that Moshe went and returned to his father-in-law, Yisro, and said to him, "Let me please go and return to my brothers in Egypt, and I will see if they're still alive." And Yisro said, "Go in peace." What do we learn from this pasuk? Why is the pasuk describing the fact that Moshe goes to Yisro? First of all, I find it very interesting. You see that Moshe showed respect for Yisro. He didn't just leave without taking leave of him. But then you say, okay, that's ordinary decency. But it does seem as though he's asking his permission. It seems as though he's requesting permission, which is an amazing thing, in that God has just called upon him. God has called upon him and told him that this is his role, imposed it upon him, really. So he's got the greatest mission in the world, the most significant thing, and it seems as though he's still at all. He just can't take his leave of Yisro. So what do you see from this? It would seem that what we call derech eretz, respect, ordinary respect, literally derech eretz, the way of the world, is significant. And a person can't just negate it. Many people often do because of the idea that they're involved in important things. So if they're involved in something very important, they may tend to overlook the ordinary requirements of what we call derech eretz. But Moshe Rabbeinu did not. You see his humbleness and his perfection. He might have thought, "I have a very important mission to do," and of course Yisro can't impede it. He can't stand in the way. Nevertheless, he shows due regard for Yisro. What's also interesting is that what does he say he's going to do? "Let me go." He tells him that he's going to go down to Egypt. But what is it? What for? For what purpose? He says, "And let me see if they're still alive." That's a very strange thing to say. He doesn't tell him the true purpose. He doesn't tell him what the real mission is. He's going, he knows what the purpose is to remove them. He doesn't tell that to Yisro. He merely mentions something which also, what do you mean, that they're still alive? As opposed to what? That they're dead? If they're all dead, he probably could have heard about it. There's ways of finding out. He doesn't have to go back. And what's the point of going back and seeing if they're still alive? Rashi says that he returned to Yisro to receive permission. Because Rashi learns that he had taken an oath, quotes the rabbis to the effect that Vayoel Moshe l'shevet ha'ish. It says, and Moshe desired to dwell with the man. That goes back to when he gave his daughter Tzipporah to Moshe for a wife. But the implication of the word Vayoel in Hebrew is an expression of Allah, an oath. So there's a midrash, the midrashic level, that Moshe took an oath not to leave without his permission. So now, according to Rashi, Moshe is returning to receive permission. He's keeping his word. He made some kind of a commitment to Yisro to stay with him. Interestingly enough, it doesn't seem that the focus here is because of the daughter. It does not seem to be the case, certainly according to Rashi. The key over here is Moshe Rabbeinu, that he had a relationship with Yisro, which was very important to Yisro for sure. And he solicited his permission. Okay, now, what is the point of saying, "I'll go and see if they're still alive"? Jesse's question is pretty good. She's saying, well, by putting it in Yisro's hands, what if he would have said no? What would Moshe have done? It's very interesting. On a midrashic level, you can trace it.
Because he let him think.
No, you can show how important the oath is. That is to say, most people in this situation would push everything aside. "I took an oath. This time, God's calling me, I have to go. If God is calling me, I have to go." All of the considerations fall by the wayside. You see from Moshe, according to the Midrash, that that does not provide any pretext. A lot of people, it's an important lesson, a lot of people, when they're engaged in what they regard as being extremely significant things for the community or for Judaism, whatever else, to a certain extent it may provide some kind of license to overlook other commitments with the attitude of, this overrides it. What I'm doing is so significant, how could you possibly complain? If you left on some mission and you should have called a friend to let them know you're going to be gone, something like that, or a relative, and you didn't do so because you were completely focused on the mission, and then afterwards they complain, why didn't you say goodbye or tell me or whatever, you know, like, can't you understand how important this is? That is an attitude that people have. The question, of course, is whether it's justified.
You know, it seems like Moshe...
It seems that it's not justified. Unless there are certain things that are emergencies. If there's an emergency, obviously, like we had the tsunami and so on and so forth, there's an emergency, so then, okay, you can't... And you have to go immediately to save or rescue, whatever. If it's determined by the need of the situation, then of course, you don't just stand around and take care of these pet... Then it's, these are petty things, obviously. But if it's not that way, such as over here, Moshe had some time. So the fact that he was able to do so, you see that there's no justification. If you took an oath, then you have to fulfill your oath. And even if you don't take it according to the Midrash, just in terms of plain Derech Eretz, you're not absolved of the obligations of Derech Eretz. You see how Moshe was meticulous. This was his father-in-law and he showed him respect. He did not disrespect him due to the fact, well, I'm engaged in something which is more significant. This is a significant thing. It's a very important element of perfection, how you deal with other people. How you deal with other people is very, very important. And covered habrios to show respect for the people and not to allow anything to distort your attitude. People are affected by any kind of a perceived progress or success. When they have some kind of success, so it affects their ego and it will have an impact on how they deal with other people. You could see that if you're perceptive and if you're honest about yourself, it could be a small thing. A person gets a promotion and now he's in a position of some kind of power in the office and so on and so forth. Very often people, fellow workers will say, not the same person, is acting differently. So it can affect a person. Because that's a very powerful emotion that people have. And very often people will treat you nicely and friendly. That's presupposing you're on the same level, so to speak. Well, of course, well, this is all arbitrary anyways. You are on the same level. But when one person achieves some type of a recognition, becomes acknowledged, success, perceives themselves to be on a little bit of a higher plane, then it affects how they relate to others. It's not the same. And that is a very serious defect. That it should not have the slightest effect on how you deal with others. That now you somehow feel that these are just ordinary people and you're on a different plane. That is a serious imperfection. Here we see Moshe Rabbeinu was the most perfected individual, the most humble person. And that's one of the areas in which it's expressed is how he deals with other people. So he shows the same regard for his father-in-law, his feelings, how he does it. As far as the question, well, what if Yisrael would have said no? That's pushing it a bit. It was framed in a request. It was framed respectfully, but pretty much Moshe is going to go. You see what I'm saying? That's still going through the proper etiquette. Yisrael was not going to say no. He wasn't putting it to him that way. He didn't say, if you say no, I won't go. Okay, I don't think that's possible. God told him to go. So Yisrael is not going to stand in the way. Nevertheless, he's showing him the full respect. As far as the reason that he gives, that I will see if they're still alive, I'll just say the pshat that I said many years ago, I think he withheld from Yisro. He didn't tell Yisro what was going to happen. That he had been chosen and that the Jews were going to be released and so on and so forth. I'll just refer to the answer that I gave. Later on, in point of fact, we see that Yisro was tremendously affected by the Exodus. And there's a whole parsha of Yisro that Yisro heard about all the wonders and the miracles that God had done. And he comes forth to meet Moshe and to talk about it and to review it and to study it. And he's amazed. Moshe tells him over the stories of everything that happened. And he sees in this an expression of divine providence. And it changes Yisro. Even though Yisro had renounced idolatry, Yisro believed in God, but he wasn't on the same level as someone like Moshe, or he wasn't prepared to be part of the Jewish people. As a result of the Exodus and all the miracles and the intervention of God, the manifestation of divine providence to the Jewish people, that had a profound impact upon Yisro. And it says that Yisro blessed God and praised God, and according to the rabbis, he then decided to convert and become Jewish, to become part of the Jewish people. I think that Moshe had a good knowledge of Yisro. He had an inkling about all these things, about what Yisro's problems were or his objections and so on and so forth, and that it's more effective. It's much more effective. He didn't want to preempt Yisro from having the experience of Egypt have an impact upon him. That is, it's, had he told them that there's a plan and what's going to happen and so on and so forth, then when it actually did happen, it would diminish the whole effect on many levels. So this way it was very modest. I'm going down there to see what I could do, obviously, to just see if that's the law, to see what I could do. Very low key. Because once it is successful, there's a certain impact that comes out, that people are watching to see what's going to happen. It's the story of the underdog. The Jews are slaves. The underdog power was powerful, the most powerful king. And the idea that the Jews could escape from there is a very compelling, that's a compelling story. So that's the Shira. The Shira describes the events, what happened when people hear. But it loses its effect if you already know in advance that there's something going to happen. In my opinion, that's my opinion, that Moshe withheld it from Yisro because let him wonder, let the suspense be there, and let him not know. And then, slowly but surely, the news comes out. And then finally, the escape, they are removed from Egypt, and then the splitting of the Red Sea. And then, he's going to, when he hears it then, it's a different hearing. That's why he says, Vayishma Yisro, Yisro heard. It's a different kind of a hearing. In terms of piquing the interest, in terms of the curiosity factor and everything that it evokes, the tremendous desire to inquire, to know, to be affected by it, there is such a thing that sometimes you're affected by an experience because it's exceedingly dramatic. Then it's best that you do not give the person any type of a forewarning about it. Because once you already know, that's the way the psyche is. You move on to something else. Every emotional reaction is short-lived. It doesn't last forever. There's no emotion in the world that lasts forever, as we all know. The most powerful emotional experiences wear off, whatever it is. It has its good side, its bad side. Obviously, when it's a positive emotion and you feel great, any intelligent person knows it's only a matter of time. It's going to wear off. That's the way the psyche is. You see people that win these lotteries, hundreds of millions of dollars, something like that, and they have this, you can imagine what the emotion of is to find out that you've won $100 million. Everybody can imagine. But then follow up with these very people who've won it, and, well, in many cases, it just makes their life worse. That's a separate point. But the emotion itself, how long do you think a person is going to be happy and satisfied just because of what happened? It's not the case. That will wear off. Now, if the person's life is improved, the person has a good use for the money, has a good philosophy of life, and knows how to use the money to achieve happiness, so then the person will be happy, but because the money enabled him to do so. But that emotion that you experience at that moment is going to fade away. And that's true of all emotions. It's also the good part of that is when you have bad emotions. No matter how painful the emotion is, in most cases, all things being equal, it's going to wear off. And Yisro said to him, Lech l'shalom. Go to peace. Then Moshe gets the message, and God said to Moshe in Midian, Lech shuv Mitzrayim. All right, now it's time to go. Go back to Egypt. By the way, I just wanted to clear up another thing in the past pasuk. When he says, I'll go and see if they're still alive, that doesn't seem to make any sense. What do you mean if they're still alive? As opposed to what? That they've all died? I think it means alive, truly alive. If the spirit, he's not talking in terms of physical life. If all the Jews in Egypt were not physically alive, had died, he would know about it or he could find out about it. He means, are they still alive? What's their state? I want to see what state of existence they're in. That's what I think he's referring to. That is similar to when Yosef says to his brothers, when he reveals himself, I am Yosef, is my father still alive? He knew that he was alive at that point. Because they had just come back. They had the party the previous day. He asked them, how's the old man, the father? And they said, he's fine. So he knew he was physically alive. Here, there too, he didn't mean it in that way. He meant it in the real sense. A person can be physically alive, but not mentally or spiritually. Now, then God tells him to go back to Egypt. Because all of those who are seeking to destroy you have died. Yeah, we have different interpretations of that. The Sforno says what we would expect. I would imagine it's talking about to the Egyptian enemies. Because Moshe had left with some enemies. He had to leave because the slaying of the Egyptian had been reported. By the Jews, no less. So the Sforno says it's a reference to Paro and his servants who sought to kill you. And it said above, Ayamas Melech Mitzrayim. So the verse said above that the king of Egypt died. That is, the original king of the enslavement, the one who initiated the policy of enslavement, he died. Then the next king took over. So now it's a reference to that group, that clique of people who Moshe had angered by his deed with the Egyptian. Rashi learns differently. Rashi on verse 19. Kimesu kol anashim, all of the men have died. Mihem, who are they? Dasan and Aviram. He says, Moshe's personal enemies. Dasan and Aviram, chayim hayu. They were really alive. Because we know that they still continue to afflict Moshe throughout the trek in the wilderness. They were still alive. So what does it mean they died? Elisha yardu menichseyem. They lost their wealth. Ve'ani chashav kemes. And a poor person is like a dead person. This is an amazing Rashi. Rashi's learning it's not referring to Paro and that group of people. It's referring, or perhaps they died as well, but the real enemies that he had to worry about were the Jewish ones. Dasan and Aviram. The ones who had done him in. And the Pasuk is using an expression, is describing it as though they died, when in point of fact they didn't die. But to all intents and purposes, they were dead. Which means to say that, this is another significant point, they had influence, they were a threat, they were a danger. Why weren't they a danger anymore? Because they lost their clout, because they lost their wealth. And practically speaking, whatever influence they had was based upon their wealth. And an ani, in this sense, in this context, it doesn't mean that a poor person is like a dead person in reality. We don't look at it that way. Philosophically, he's not. To the contrary. We say that Me'ania Yisrael Yosei Sora. From the poor of Israel comes forth the Torah. Historically, that segment of the population that produced the Torah scholars were the poorer ones, because they put all their energy into thought. They didn't have wealth to distract them or to provide them with some kind of gratification. So we don't mean that the poor person is like a dead person in truth, but it means from this angle, practically speaking, in terms of being a macher, a mover and a shaker, if you want to have influence in the Jewish community, It's not just the Jewish community as far as if you want to go in politics. Pretty much most of the influential people are wealthy. It's wealth. You donate enough to somebody's campaign, you have clout. And you'll be treated with respect. But what happens after you lose your money? No one's going to be interested in you. Any great person, influential person, who lost his wealth, that's the end of it. No one's going to be there. All those people that showed respect for you. Anyways, that's what Rashi says it's referring to. There's another sense in which an ani can be considered like a mace. It's a tragic sense. I'm saying, in reality, he's not like a mace. Because I'm assuming it's not his fault that that's a condition that can affect people. People can be in poverty. However, if the person is involved in study and knowledge and learning, so then of course he's living a very useful life. We're not saying that he's like a dead person, that his life is meaningless. We're not saying that. And thus, if a person is poor, there's no reason why he should feel miserable. However, there's a reality in terms of the social context. In terms of the social context, he's clearly diminished. That's because that's an imperfection in society. The society looks down upon it because society overestimates what so-called success and possessions. So therefore, the society tends to look down upon the ani. And that's the sense in these psukim. That's why Dustin and Aviram were alive, but they were dead in terms of having any influence, so they couldn't be a harm. They wouldn't be a threat to Moshe because they had no influence. That's what it means. There is a further sense, though, in that the ani himself, unfortunately, will suffer because he's affected by the attitude of the society. He himself buys into that, and since he feels, he perceives that he's being looked down upon, so this gets to him. And that's a tragedy. It doesn't have to. There are certain individuals who have very strong constitutions, mental constitutions, and they don't care. They're not affected by the society. Inwardly, they're very content because they don't care. They don't need money and they don't care about society's approval. But by and large, it's going to affect the individual. That is the idea of the Midrash, which says that there's three people that are considered to be like dead. A woman that doesn't have children, the Metzora, the leper, and the Ani. In that sense, it's because in each case, they are, in a sense, an outcast in the society. In the case of the Metzora, the leper, he's shunned by society. So the fact that the person is shunned by society affects him. He's diminished. And his whole sense of self is compromised. And the same is true with a woman that can't have children. Although here it's rooted in something very, indigenous to the woman. The woman has a very powerful maternal instinct, maternal desire, so then it's even more difficult. But even if she could get over that, then it has to do with the whole societal thing. Now let's go to the next pasuk. Vayikach Moshe es ishto v'es banav. And Moshe took his wife and his children, Vayarkivei malach hamor, and put them on the donkey. The Sforno learns that he was taking them back to Midian to put them in his father-in-law's house. So the Sforno learns the whole thing that he never really took them down to Egypt. The other Mefarshim learned that he was going to come take them down to Egypt. But then, of course, we know that when Yisro comes, he brings his wife and children with him. So apparently, after all is said and done, they're back there with their father in Midian, one way or another. So either he took them with him, then he sent them back. According to some, he actually came back for a while. After the failure of his first mission to Paro, he came back for 6 months. Whatever the case, we're not really that doesn't concern us right now. Let's learn it simplistically. As you read the verses, the impression is given that he puts them on the donkey to take them to Egypt. And then something that nobody could have anticipated occurs. Vayoshev Arta Mitzrayim, and he returns to the land of Egypt. Vayikach Moshe as Mate Hualukim Biyodo. And Moshe took the staff of God in his hand. Parenthetically, with regard to this donkey, there's an interesting Rashi, a Midrash, that this was the donkey that Avram had used when he went to the Akedah, and in the future, the Mashiach will be revealed on this donkey. That's a midrash, not the literal meaning. Interestingly, though, later on, Moshe refers to the donkey in the case of the rebellion of Korach, where he says, Lo chamor echad nasasi mehem, that they were accusing him of abusing power for personal concerns, and he said, I never took even a donkey from them. Lo chamor echad nasasi mehem. So Rashi comments, the donkey, even this donkey that he went down to Egypt on, didn't take it from the communal funds. He took it from his own. That is, he was going on a mission for the people. He had a right to charge it to their bill. Why does he have to use his own? It was going down for them. But now he says, even that, even where I had the opportunity to use the communal transportation, even then I didn't do that, didn't indulge. Which means I didn't get any benefit whatsoever for myself. Now something strange happens. Then it says that God said to Moshe, when you return to Egypt, take note of all of the wonders that I've placed in your hand, and you'll do them before Paro, and I will harden his heart, and he won't send the nation out. And you will say to Paro, thus says God, Bini Bechori Yisrael, my son, my firstborn is Israel. Firstborn. Which Rashi says is a expression of greatness. And I say unto you, send forth my son and let him serve me. And if you refuse to send him forth, then I will kill your firstborn son. So this apparently seems to be a reference to it's a warning, it's a reference to the ultimate punishment that he would pay. And by the way, this Forno makes an interesting point. In accordance with his position, which we've discussed, that the Makos were not punishments. The plagues were not punishments. They were signs and wonders to give Paro the opportunity to come to a recognition of God. The punishment, however, came after all those opportunities, after the nine so-called plagues, and Paro refused. Then God punished them with the killing of the firstborn. That the final plague, the killing of the firstborn, was punishment. And here is the place where he's getting his warning. That ultimately, if he does not listen, this will be the penalty that he has to pay. What happens next? Here is the part that we couldn't anticipate. And Bayiba Derech Bamalon, they were on the road, in the lodging. So they traveled the distance and they lodged for the night. Then it says that he was encountered by God, and he sought to kill him. According to Rashi, it's an angel, obviously. A certain force. We don't know what form it took. But something happened, and Moshe got deathly ill. Vayivakesh Hamiso. So God, who had just been talking to him, God who had instructed him, now is the cause of an illness which could be fatal. But we don't know what happened. We're completely at a loss. I don't know how people can read it unless you can figure it out perhaps from the next pasuk. The next pasuk says that Zipporah, his wife, took a flint and she removed the foreskin of her son. And then she tossed it on the ground by his foot. And she said, you are a chasan damim. The words over here get very, very difficult. A groom of blood are you unto me. Rashi says that she was saying, you caused my chasan, my husband, to be killed because of you. So he puts it in different words. Horeg ishi atoli. A killer of my husband are you unto me. Rashi learns Vatagala Raglov on 25 that she cast the foreskin before the feet of Moshe. Then she said, with reference to her son, so this statement that you are a killer of husband, of my husband unto me, she said that with reference to her son. Then it says that it lightened up from him, that he started to get better. So you do see, it's clear from the story itself, that something occurred to Moshe, a very serious illness, because the child had not been circumcised. Which is very difficult to understand about Moshe Rabbeinu, that he would not take care of that matter of circumcising the son. Then it says that he started to get better. Azamra, then she said, Chasan damim lamulos, which Rashi interprets to mean, al davar hamulos, because of the matter of circumcision. That is, because of the circumcision, one's husband could be a husband of blood, can be killed. She's simply, according to this, reiterating what she said before, which requires some explanation. It seems that she understood. It seems that Tzipora understood what the problem was. And she took action. See, sometimes you have to take action. There's a time for prayer, because she doesn't just pray. Whether she prays at all over here is not clear. It's interesting that she didn't pray at that point. She did what had to be done. So that's important to know, that sometimes you have to do things, actions. And then she makes this declaration, which could be a tefillah. The Rashbam, and it seems the Sforno learns that her first statement, which she said, Chasan damim matoli, you are a groom of blood unto me, is in the form of a prayer. Which would make a lot of sense, that first she did what she had to do, and then tefillah, then she had to pray. Because there's no guarantee, she didn't know, there's no guarantee that just by correcting the situation, would be able to save Moshe. Sometimes it's too late. If that's the punishment, there's no guarantee that she was able to effectuate a change. But she did what she had to do. And then she prayed. And then she recognized, after the fact, that this was the cause, and then she had she was grateful that it was successful. It's a recognition. The question is, what was the sin? Apparently Moshe committed a sin, for which, it seems, he was deserving of death. And even someone like Moshe, they had absolute justice here. And even on the way to perform the mission of taking out the Jews, if that's what has to be, that's what has to be. So what would happen to the Jews? As we say, God has many different messengers. Harber shluchim yeshlam. But what was the sin? How are we to understand this? Why didn't he circumcise his child? Now Rashi says, because he didn't circumcise his son Eliezer. And because he was lax, he was punished. Then he quotes other sources, because that don't accept the fact that Moshe was lax. And he quotes Rabbi Yossi, who says, heaven forbid, Moshe wasn't lax, but rather he had a dilemma. Because the time had come to leave. He was faced with two obligations over here. So he said, if I circumcise, before he goes out on the journey, if I circumcise and go out and start to travel, so that's dangerous for the child for 3 days. So 3 days is the most dangerous time. Especially in those days, we don't have medicine like today. But if I circumcise and then wait 3 days, but God commanded me to go and return to Egypt. So you see, things are not that simplistic. A person like Moshe Rabbeinu in this situation can face a big dilemma. And there's no guarantee that God's going to resolve it for you. And why was he punished with death? Because he busied himself with the lodging first. The Rambam in chapter 3 of Laws of Milah, circumcision. In fact, it's the final halacha. He says, come and see how serious is Mila? Shelo nitla l'Moshe Rabbeinu ala afilu sha'achas, because Moshe Rabbeinu was not even given a short period of a respite over the fact that he put off the Mila. Was not given any room. And afal pi shayah baderach, even though he was on the road. It seems from the Rambam that the punishment of Moshe over here had to do with the seriousness of Mila. And that had it been something else, a different mitzvah, the outcome might not have been the same. That Moshe was preoccupied with something of extreme importance. God had commanded him go down to Egypt and so forth. He did everything correctly. And of course, even according to the story, Moshe was going to do the Mila, just that he was putting it off a little bit. And he treated the mitzvah like an ordinary mitzvah. And it was a failure to recognize the supreme significance of this mitzvah, which goes back to the entire covenant that God made with Avraham Avinu. Right, so Jesse is suggesting that it's connected to the whole idea of the mission that Moshe was on, which is basically to save Klal Yisrael, the Jewish people. However, the whole essence of the Jewish people is based upon the bris, the covenant of circumcision, which was effectuated between God and Avraham Avinu. And that is the foundation. So that Moshe Rabbeinu was going to do something for the benefit of Klal Yisrael. However, he should have realized that the whole existence of Klal Yisrael, the Jewish people, is connected to the bris of every particular individual. Every particular bris is an aspect, is a component of the fabric of the Jewish people. And that explains, in a sense, what she meant. Tzipporah recognized, and she sort of spoke to the child, that you, the individual child, is a source of my husband being killed over you, meaning over the failure to recognize that in each and every case and to circumcise you. Each particular circumcision is a component in maintaining the whole identity of the Jewish people. We should be very careful. No one is suggesting that Moshe Rabbeinu did not appreciate the importance of Mila. He certainly did. It means, though, in this context, in this situation, whatever it was that affected him and caused him to make a different judgment, not to do it immediately, then the punishment, the harshness of the punishment has to do with the fact that it did entail a certain type of negation of the significance of the circumcision. That's what this is all about.